kind of the structure of the day is we're going to have some sort of talk teaching sessions, then we'll have some discussion a little bit, some time for question and answer, and then we'll have practice sessions. So we're kind of going to be able to go through a few different methods to sort of work with the topics we're covering today. I hope it also sort of breaks it up a little bit. Also, some of you may be new today, like as Jill introduced me, mostly my training has been within the Tibetan lineages of Buddhism. I know a little Theravada, but essentially Theravada is within Tibetan Buddhism, but there might be some slightly different styles, also some slightly different terminology, things like that. But ultimately, I think if you've been studying Theravada, you'll be able to relate them. Yeah? So, but also, if any questions come up, please ask. Either if I can't answer them, then Jill and Bruce can also help. So if there's not so much familiarity with the Tibetan styles or the Tibetan lineage, I think it's okay. The motto for the whole day is creating sort of spaciousness, you know, not open space, but we can all be together. We can all share sort of in the exchange with each other, also in the Dharma with each other, and then at the same time create sort of a space within ourselves. So we're relating with our emotions, our thought patterns, our habitual patterns, and relating with them and creating a lot of space. So in this space, there's a lot of compassion within that kind of space. There's a lot of loving kindness towards ourselves and others, you see? And then, at the same time, there's sort of an openness where if there's some confusion or also just excitement about something, the spaciousness allows for pliability. Does that make sense? Yeah? So I think whatever we go through today, just that's sort of our motto, is the right word? Our running, you know, motto for the day. Just spaciousness, yeah? Hopefully some of the practices I'm going to talk about, we're going to spend time practicing, it'll create that spaciousness. That's sort of the goal. So also just in welcoming you guys, we're starting, like Jill said, I just came back from 2 months in Nepal, and I feel right at home in Santa Cruz because everybody's on Nepali time. Nepali time is, 15, 20, 30 minutes within it, you know? And it's nice. Actually, within that, there's some space, no? Because often in our culture here in America, you know, for better or worse, we have great things about our culture and things that also cause us a lot of emotional anxiety and things like that and don't necessarily benefit our Dharma practice. So often, you know, the punctuality can kind of serve as a anti-spacious thing sometimes. It doesn't have to, but often it does, yeah? So we're starting off on a nice, spacious Nepali Santa Cruz time. So also I just think we should take a second to really rejoice, you know, because, you know, a lot of you probably are Dharma practitioners for a long time. Some maybe are new to it. Some are maybe medium, you know, a few years. Just really rejoicing that we're able to come together, you know, and talk about Dharma, talk about Buddha Dharma, talk about how to relate to our emotions, our thought patterns. It's really a rare opportunity. So sometimes it's easy to get sort of, I'm speaking for my, you know, for myself, it's very easy to get stuck in where we get used to a sort of pattern, and then we forget how fortunate we are, actually. And then we forget the fortune of the spiritual teachings we've been given from our teachers, from our peers. So I think just take a second to just really rejoice that we're able to come together and talk about these things. Yeah, it's really fortunate. A lot of people in the world don't even have either access to Dharma or a spiritual path, or they might not be interested in it. It could be two different things. Yeah, and that's okay. But it's very fortunate to be able to come together. Do most of you guys know each other? Is that the case or not the case? Okay. So maybe we're just going to take like 1 or 2 minutes and just say hi to your neighbor. and just get to know each other a little bit. Yeah?
Hello.
Jill just said, oh, you don't know what you've let loose. And I thought, oh, yes, it's Santa Cruz. There's not much ice to break. That's really nice to see, actually. So then I just wanted to give you guys an opportunity. I mean, of course, you have an opportunity to, anytime you have a question or you want to raise your hand within reason, please do and say whatever you want. But I do want to take a few minutes right now. Just kind of what you guys are coming here with, sort of what kind of practice issues, maybe life issues you're looking to get out of the day, or if it's just not things you're looking for out of the day, just maybe things you're working with in your life, but more related to practice. And if you don't have necessarily a daily practice or you're newer to Buddhism, then maybe some life issues that that you're working with that, you know, you'd like to talk about today. Does that make sense? So if anyone wants to, this will help me to get to know you guys a little bit, yeah? They can also come up throughout the day, but maybe there's some now that you, I'll try to fit them in there in the talks.
Well, by saying, hi, my name's Rachel. By this practice being about emotions,
mm-hmm.
What I've been really sitting with and really letting process is my sorrow and my sadness. And those are some of the feelings, sorrow, sadness, and grief, and cutting my losses. And really letting it go through me and not trying to suppress it. So I'm just really like sitting with it, embracing it, and breathing. It hurts. Because I've suppressed it, but now I want those feelings of uncomfortableness. I want to experience them. Mm-hmm. I want them to let my body just have that, you know, and be in acceptance of both parts when I'm in success, when I'm in sorrow and sadness. So I'm learning that.
That's really great. Yeah. No, thank you.
And I'm grateful today for the practice of the emotions and the wisdom.
Yeah.
The skillfulness with that,
yeah.
Because that's something that I always pushed aside. I don't want to feel that. I don't want anyone to know. I don't want anyone to know I'm sad. But now I'm in, you know, it's coming up inside of me. Let it flow.
Great. Wow.
Yeah, you spoke my heart. Thank you. Dealing with difficult emotions and ones that, I want to open and soften to, in part so that I can take away those barriers to my full experience of others. So softening my heart, including to the pain and difficulty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Another type of pain, but one thing that's been on my mind is working with my thoughts that I should be sitting more, or I should be mindful in a certain way, and trying to be more open and flexible for all the ways to practice.
That's a big one for me.
The difference in feeling of intellectually accepting the impermanence of emotions and the actual being with them and not being overwhelmed by them. Being happy or so.
I find a little hypnosis pattern of just doing something that frustrates me and starting to cuss out loud or to myself and just really immediately getting into an angry spot. Since I become aware of that, I like to disengage that habit. So that's something that I'm trying to do.
Sometimes, also, in my case, I disengage with that habit and then it re-engages.
I really want to develop awareness and differentiation between the way the different emotions feel in my body.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I can tell I'm feeling something emotional, just sink into it, and then, and then maybe some intellectualizing kicks in. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And so just have more presence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. I'm taking notes of what you guys are saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, keep going if there's more.
It's the high tech.
Yeah.
I'll jump in. I guess I'm challenged by I'm having some very strong emotions because of some changes in my life, and I'm noticing that the strong emotions identify them. They're immediate.
Mm-hmm.
And my awareness of them kind of blurs. Are they me?
No.
But they're strong, so they sort of like feel like this wave is taking me out.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't, it makes it very difficult to touch my awareness, or the power of my observing. It's like, oh. So I thought, I might get some support from a, higher level.
Yeah. No, that's really good. Yeah.
I have worked with, I have a lump in my throat. I have worked with my emotions and have known for many years that my emotions have been dampened. That I have a lot of intense emotions, but I can't get to them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting to them now. I know there's a lot of fear there because I might just go off the deep end, kind of. It's really, I think, in my head because my mother was mentally ill. And unbeknownst to me, I think I've based my life that I'm not going to be like that. So everything gets kind of dampened down. And I'm working with that a lot these days. So this day of working with emotions and difficult emotions is very important. And I echo what people have said. I don't know if your names are Rebecca or Rachel. I know it's one. Rachel and Leslie especially have said.
Yeah.
That everybody has said so far.
Yeah. And
maybe
one or two more. Yeah.
Oh, my name is Deborah.
Hi.
And I'm about a year in practice in front of you. What I experience a lot when I'm sitting is sudden emergence of traumatic memory.
Mm.
And it's often not with emotion, it's just kind of a shock. And when I sit with it to kind of see what's there in, like, emotionally, it's pretty overwhelming, a lot of fear, terror. Kind of going from 0 to 60, where I'll feel peaceful, but then there's, traumatic memory is pretty shocking, or the feelings attached to it are pretty overwhelming, and overwhelming physically. It can have a lot of physical manifestation, freezing and shuddering.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think about my life, and I've gone extremes, emotions, and then I've always tried therapy in different ways. And then when I found Buddhism, I heard, there's this neutral place. So, and it is what it is. So then I find this place, and I go, then I don't have to feel all of this. And, but am I supposed to feel all of this? No, I'm supposed to come back to what is. But then something will trigger me. And rather than working through it, I go, it's what it is. And so I don't know if I'm just sort of turning off the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to learn about how to navigate through them with a Buddhist perspective. Because I like the idea of it's what it is, and I calm down. But I don't know if I'm ignoring it or pushing it away. And so I just feel like I've become apathetic. And I go, that's better than... So it's this game.
You guys have really, really good things to say. I'm excited now. I was excited before. Yeah, really, really good. Thank you for sharing. Yeah. I'm going to try to cover this. I think all these are going to end up coming up in what I was already planning. But also, please feel free throughout the day if I didn't cover something or you want to re-mention it or sort of touch on a specific you know, characteristic of something, please say again, and others too. So, just before we start here, what I'd like to do is, before I start the teaching, is recite a few prayers, if that's okay with you guys. So usually within my tradition, we recite refuge in bodhicitta, which I think the refuge part is very common in the Theravada, if you guys are used to that. And then the four boundless states, which are more or less a metta practice. Yeah. So just before we start, I'll give you guys a little bit of background for those who aren't familiar. And also, I think often in our culture, you know, we've been cut off a little bit sometimes from access to what the real meaning and way to interact with prayers is, or reciting or chanting. You see what I'm saying? So some of us haven't, but I was. And so it's taken me a few years to really connect with, okay, well, why in Buddhism is there chanting? Why is there prayers? You know, why not just sit? You know what I mean? So in general, I mean, the first prayer here is refuge, and then bodhicitta. But generally, in Buddhism, refuge, as most of you know, refuge is sort of the basis of the path. You know, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha as realized practitioners. The Dharma as the teaching, and the Buddha as the teacher. Yeah. So when we take refuge in that, we're sort of, what we're doing is we're switching the attitude in our hearts and minds. We're switching the attitude from taking refuge in sort of outward sources of just material gain, or, you know, chocolate, or for me it's like a movie here and there, you know what I mean? So we're switching that refuge into a refuge of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Buddha being, you know, as most of you know, the life story of the Buddha, a being who saw his potential and actually awoke and arose out of samsara for the benefit of others. And then the Dharma is the teaching that actually, the path he followed to attain that state. And then the Sangha as the practitioners of realized practitioners who are practicing that path of Dharma. You know? So by taking refuge in these, it actually turns our mind towards the path of Dharma and towards these practices that are able to transform us. And I think you can think of it in a religious way, or you can think of it in a really practical way, like I'm saying. You see? So that's the first prayer, and then the second prayer here is on the four boundless states, as you can see there. So this is just this kind of prayer. So outside of the refuge prayer, you then have different kinds of prayers. Prayers where you're actually, they're a meditation within themselves. So as we're reciting the words, we're resting on them, we're thinking about them, we're sort of working with our emotions in order to turn our emotions into what the prayer is saying. So they become tools of meditation, actually. Yeah. Similarly, there's prayers of aspiration. So some of the dedication prayers are aspiration prayers. So these are prayers sort of turning our mind to what we want in the future, what we want to actually accomplish with our Dharma path. So all of this sort of adds potential to our Dharma path. I mean, it's I notice sometimes in the West, I don't know what it quite comes from, but when we approach Eastern religious paths, sometimes we want to focus on one aspect of it. But in actuality, if you look at the whole path, there's a lot of tools within it. You see what I'm saying? And it's okay to focus on one thing. I think in the beginning that's really helpful, because often it's too much. Especially Tibetan Buddhism, it's like they got everything. The whole walls are covered with tankas and bells and horns and, you know, monks and all this kind of thing, yeah? So it can be a little bit overwhelming, yeah? But, you know, so it's good to focus on one thing. But then as our path sort of widens and, you know, we start practicing more months, more years, we're going to need lots of tools. Just like in life, how you need all kinds of things to pull out at different times. So the more tools we have, actually the more success we'll have, because it enables us flexibility. It also enables us power and sort of confidence. So prayers are one tool. Does that make sense? And chanting, yeah. Again, but if it's just done, who cares? I mean, seriously, who cares? You know? Mm-hmm. And actually a lot of, Asian cultures, some people, they just show up and just say things and then they leave the other door and just do the opposite, you know? So I don't think there's something missing there too, right? Also, some prayers are requesting blessings. So this is something that is definitely part of the Buddha, the Buddhism religious aspect. But generally, I think blessings are a difficult thing to understand. They're simple, but they're difficult. Because I think in our culture, we also want a lot of empirical, sort of scientific, this is this, and it, you know, you put these two together and this comes. But blessings are something intangible, they're something we can't touch, they're something profound, too. So a lot, some prayers are actually requesting the blessings of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Arhats, these beings who have actually attained aspects of the path who can benefit us, and requesting blessings in order to help us on our path. So this is another aspect. So I'm just saying this, if you can't relate to it, don't worry. I'm just sort of giving the background of it. Those are the different kinds of prayers. These are just here with the Refuge Mudita explaining, and the four balance states, this is actually a meditation. Right? So I'll read it real, we'll read it slowly. And we're going to chant some in Tibetan. The only reason is because that I'm coming, because my lineage is Tibetan, I like to connect with that a little bit and with the language of that lineage. And then, we'll recite once in Tibetan and then twice in English so we can spend more time in meaning. Yeah? And then I'm going to recite some prayers alone that are just part of the lineage prayers that you guys don't have to do. Yeah? Okay, so here are the Refuge in Bodhicitta prayer. Sangye chodang sarki chanam ba John chum bang du dar ni kya su chi Dar ki chin so ki pe so nam ki Dro la pen chir sangye dru par sho In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Sangha, I take refuge until enlightenment. By the merit of practicing the Paramitas, may I attain Buddha, the benefit of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Sangha, I take refuge until enlightenment. By the merit of practicing the Paramitas, may I attain Buddha, for the benefit of all beings. Four balance states. Sanchen panche dewa dhamme vayulam vayurche Durnal dhamme nalki gurdam drawar jurche Durnal mepe dewa dhamme drawar jurche Nilin chandan nidam drawar May all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and its causes. May they never lose a happiness free from sorrow. May they be free from attraction, aversion, or partiality, and remain in great equanimity. May all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and its causes. May they never lose a happiness free from sorrow. May they be free from attraction, aversion, partiality, and remain in great equanimity. So while I recite the next chant, if you'd like, you can sort of dwell on sort of these last, the four balanced states here. Just think about them. We're going to talk about them later, but if you get bored of hearing my voice, you can do that. So So, there's this quote from the Buddha that I'd like to sort of work with. I was actually thinking to put it, is there like a board we can write it on that people can, you don't have to do it now. Yeah, maybe in the break. So Joe will write it on the board so you guys can, you can write it down now if you want, but you could also just take a note during the break. And this is something I just want to keep coming back to throughout the day. And I want you guys to be reflecting on it throughout the day. It's actually quite a lot here. It's a simple quote, but there's a lot. And there's many ways to approach this quote. So here it is. The Buddha said, "We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. Speak and act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow." I'll repeat it two more times. We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. Speak and act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow. We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. Speak and act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow. Yeah? It's beautiful, yeah? So more or less the teaching that I'm giving is going to be based around this. A little loosely, but it will be. And I'd like to come back to the quote, I don't know, at least at the end of the day, if not sort of two more times throughout the day, and sort of talk about it. And I want you guys to think about it as well, yeah? And we'll have some discussion on it. So just to begin today, I wanted to start by talking about mindfulness of body. So this is something that I'm sure a lot of you guys have had a lot of teaching on. I think the Theravada tradition is taught a lot. This is a big meditation, yeah? I'm going to give a slightly different approach to it here because I'm going to add in some aspects of the Tibetan lineage on the subtle body. Generally, the subtle body is it's not really taught until the more advanced teachings in Buddhism where they're doing yogas and yogic exercises to try to sort of enact and also help to manifest certain mind states. And they're trying to purify these aspects of the subtle body in order to enable that. So usually they're not, these kind of teachings on the subtle body aren't given until then. But my teacher, Sogner Rinpoche, a lot of this in this session is going to come from him. So he feels that the kind of information on what the subtle body is and sort of the health of the subtle body should be taught to people even new to Buddhism. Because what this does is it allows us the knowledge to understand more aspects of our body, more than just the physical body. And then it also helps us to realize where a lot of our emotional imbalance is actually coming from. Yeah? Before we get into the subtle body, I just wanted to talk a little bit about resting in the body. So, I think maybe people in Santa Cruz don't have this problem. so maybe I don't need to talk to you guys about it. But often, as you guys know, I'm sure, most of us are quite disembodied. So our sort of, this came up in some of the questions, yeah, or some of the interactions we just had where I was asking people sort of what they want to get out of the day, what their experiences are lately, and obstacles. So then, often what happens to us in sort of modern culture is we have our mind or our thought patterns, and we have our sort of intellectual ideas, these kind of things, and then we have our emotional center. And often, slowly this gets split. No, you can't actually split them because, you know, we're in a body and we're whole in a way, yes? But what happens is slowly there's some kind of disconnect that happens. And this happens through speediness, sort of modern cultural demands, our education system, things like that. And, you know, I'm not saying all of the education system, you know, a lot of it's great. I actually had the experience where I'm in Nepal, and I'm like, there's very little education there for people. I mean, cognitive education, yeah? So then, I mean, some people will have it, but a lot of people are not educated. And so you get a lot of problems that just happen by not being able to think sort of straight. You know what I'm saying? And so I realized, oh, wow, I had a really good school when I was young. On that side, on the cognitive side, we're one of the more developed nations in that sort of sense. But as far as the emotional side, as many of you know, we're not sort of educated in that. So a lot of us are sort of stunted or cut off from our emotions and from the ability to relate with them, the ability to understand them, having some kind of like Daniel Goleman has this emotional intelligence. He sort of coined that phrase. I think Sogyam Trungpa. You know the term he uses? Emotional. I forgot. Sogyam Trungpa uses a different term, but more or less, you have these two elements of cognitive and emotional, and they both have their own kind of way of knowing. Yeah, but in a modern world, this gets a little bit split off. Not in every single person. I have a friend who grew up really rural in the Midwest. And he seems to be quite, you know, in touch with his emotional center. Because the emotional center, it doesn't care so much about, like, knowing every single list of this or how to add, you know, how to do, long division, things like that. The emotional center doesn't really care about that. It has an intelligence of how to relate with the different kinds of kleshas, the different kinds of interactions with people, these kind of things, yeah? And then the cognitive, that's in the cognitive realm, you know, long division, all these kind of lists of things, memorization. Now, this shouldn't be cut off. They should actually go together. But what happens for a lot of us is slowly they get cut off, yeah? So, resting in the body, I think, is a really healing way to remedy this. Resting in the body is sort of like ground zero. You know, it's sort of where we can come to first. It's really simple to do. It's very practical. We can do it anywhere. We can do it sitting in the car, as long as we're paying attention. We can do it, you know, at work, wherever. And what this does is it centers our, not only our mind, sort of our thought patterns in the body, but it also settles our subtle body. So I'm going to get into the subtle body a little bit later. So then we're going to practice. So I'm just sort of talking right now, and then I'll guide some of the meditation later. So don't worry if this isn't all sinking in. I'll repeat it a lot. Yeah. Also, I mean, many of you have experience with this kind of meditation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So then, from resting in the body, then we find some kind of spaciousness, right? But there's a spaciousness in the body. There's kind of this. It's a feeling of openness, of just well-being. There's not like this kind of pushing, you know, kind of go feeling or anxiety, these kind of things. So this is the kind of spaciousness that can come from resting in the body and also balancing the subtle body. Then we can bring awareness to the body. This is sort of the next step in the meditation. We bring awareness to the body when we're resting in it. We can notice different sensations, right? This is more the actual mindfulness part of mindfulness of body. And we can recognize the sensation, let it go. Yeah, I think you're familiar with that. So then we come to recognizing subtle sensations. So a preliminary to the subtle body practices with subtle body health is this sort of being able to rest in the gross body, just our physical skin, bones, these kind of things. Rest in them, be able to recognize sensations, be able to sort of find some kind of spaciousness in the physical body, some kind of base point. Usually for me it's here, you know, they call it Dantian and Qigong. In Tibetan Buddhism they have the navel chakra is here. I think, what other names do they have for it? Solia, exactly. So you could find a base. Some people use their feet, because the feet are quite grounding. Yeah. So if you're sitting in a chair, sometimes the feet, if you're up here a lot, the feet can be quite grounding. And just resting in that, and then recognizing the sensations, keeping some concentration, and just recognizing when something flows through. You know, there's practices where you're naming it, right, these kind of things. Then, through that, it's going to lead to a more subtle way of feeling and sort of interacting with the subtle body. So, I've talked so much about it, so now here it is. The subtle body. In Tibetan Buddhism, they break up the subtle body into three sort of categories. So you have something called nadi, prana, and bindu. So those are the Sanskrit terms, but in Tibetan they're sa, lung, and tigle, and then in English they're channels, winds, and drops. Winds sometimes, it's prana is another word people use for it, right? So like life force energy in yoga, they use that, hatha yoga. So the channels are the parts of our body where they're the more subtle. I think in Chinese medicine they're similar to meridians, but they're a little bit different here. But they might be the same, we're not sure. So generally we have channels going throughout all our body. They're energy channels that carry the winds, and they also carry the drops. And the drops are sort of the spark of life. These drops are sort of when we're feeling really down and really depressed, no energy. This means the drops in our body are a little bit dry. Generally, this happens from too much excitement, too much sort of pushing, very busy kind of life. The drops or tigle in our body can sort of dry up. Yeah, I'm just giving you guys the framework right now, so you don't have to. If it's too much information, don't worry. You don't have to take it all in. It's just sort of a framework. You can still do the practice without knowing it. So then the prana or life force energy or winds. This is what actually creates life. We wouldn't be alive if we didn't have prana or lung. They call it lung in Tibetan. So this is what we're able to see, we're able to hear. It helps to have the senses sort of awake, as well as it's actually linked with our mind and consciousness itself. Yeah? It's what, right, the consciousness sort of rides these winds around. And our thoughts, our emotions are all linked with this subtle energy or prana, yeah? So, is that clear? So the channels sort of are throughout the body. They carry the winds to different places. They also carry the drops, which is this sort of spark of life. And normally in a healthy individual with a healthy subtle body, they're still going to have issues with their channels, where there's knots in certain channels in certain places in the subtle body. And at the same time, there's bends and things like that. So the winds get stuck in these areas, and then disease can manifest, and then can eventually manifest outwardly. Usually it starts as an emotional disease, or can be a disease of the nervous system, like anxiety, something like this. And then it can go more into depression, different things, and then it can manifest in sort of a more gross disease, you know, in the physical body. So so the whole process, so most people have some sort of imbalance. When your channels are straight and the winds are able to flow freely through them, you can become enlightened very fast. So this is the process yogis are trying to do. They're trying to work these channels so they're able to straighten them, they're able to untie the knots and make them healthy. And then it's very easy to gain realization in meditation. But here we're not going to talk about the that side of it. We're just going to talk about the health side of it. Yeah, just the basic health of the subtle body. So what happens when the channels get bends in them is the lung or prana gets sort of stuck. And it ends up sort of repeating in a circle. And then it can't flow freely. And so then it triggers adverse emotional responses. It creates habitual patterns and sort of ways, thought patterns that aren't so healthy. And so from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, when it's related to the subtle body, actually all of our emotional disturbances, sort of habitual patterns that aren't so healthy, they actually come from an imbalance in the subtle body. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I'm sort of correlating these two. So then how to work with this, yeah? So I talked about cultural specific issues where our lung generally from speediness, from the cognitive being cut off from the emotional center, our prana or lung gets sort of excessive in certain areas and then also becomes sort of stuck in a pattern. So usually we have a lot of excessive lung in the West, we have a lot of excessive lung in the heart area and in the head. So then what can happen is a lot of anxiety, a lot of eventually depression can happen. And like for me, I get tightness here and then tightness behind my shoulder blades, you know, right back there. So that's an indication that there's too much gloom in that area. And, you know, there's lots of remedies for this medically, Chinese medicine, Tibetan medicine, any kind of herbal medicine that's working with the meridians and with the subtle body. It's going to be able to help. Massage really helps. But what we're going to do today is some meditation to work with this. Often we have to work with it with our thought patterns as well, and with the way we're relating to those sensations. So this is why it relates to this meditation on mindfulness of body, because eventually through being aware of the sensations in our gross body, we can become aware of the sensations in our subtle body. But I'm going to give you an example now, because I've been talking for a while, so it's and I'm boring you. So it's a little bit tricky to work with this, with the sensations in the subtle body, because the subtle body is too subtle to actually feel. It's not physical, and actually usually only very qualified yogis can actually access it and feel the loom of it. So, but what we can feel is the result of the patterns. You see? So it's a little like this. This is the example that Sobhnyi Rinpoche gives. So this is our body, yeah? Our physical body, with the subtle body, everything, the whole package, our nervous system, everything. This is the actual, the prana, or loom. That's certain. Is anybody confused about what these three aspects are? If so, please say, I can clarify things. Yeah, it's pretty clear. The channels, the winds, and the drops. Yeah. Mostly here we're worrying about the winds. Because through working with the winds, it actually helps to create health in the rest of it. So mainly I'm going to talk about the winds. So here is the winds. So often, the winds will be sort of circulating in an area around the body, but when we have a loom imbalance, they'll be stuck in a certain area. Now, the key is, what, for instance, are we able, like I said, we can't necessarily feel this. We're not feeling this hitting the subtle body, but what can we be aware of in this sort of example?
The sound.
Exactly. So the sound. So the sound here, it correlates to our nervous system. So normally, we can have some sort of interaction with it, and we could feel in our nervous system what emotional imbalance is creating. Also, like for me, I like I said, I do get pressure here. Sometimes people feel a little bit like foggy in their heads. You know what I mean? This is a sign that the loom is too high here. So what we're mainly trying to do, I think, through mindfulness of body meditation in this practice is trying to be aware of that. But at the same time, we need a technique in order to work with it. So then what we need to do is a practice called gentle Vajra breath. So the Vajra breath is usually a practice taught in higher Vajrayana Buddhism in order to, like I said, more purify the body into creating realization. Here we're just trying to gain health. It's not, of course it will benefit our practice and meditation practice, but more or less the gentle Vajra breath is just that, it's gentle. It's used to sort of create health. And what we're doing is, here is sort of the home of the prana. Here's the home of the winds, yeah? In the Dantian navel chakra area. About 70% of our winds should reside here most of the time. But, you know, of course we need winds throughout all our body, otherwise we can't walk, we can't see. But we need most of it here. The problem is, a lot of us have a lot of it here, and a lot of it here. Right? Mm-hmm. But again, this is something individual. Some of you might not, you know. In my case, I do, so I have to work with this gentle Vajra breath practice. And the gentle Vajra breath is real simple. I'm just going to explain it, and then we'll probably take a break in a little bit and then actually do it as sort of a guided meditation. So, in general, what we're doing is we're using the breath, inhaled through the nose, then we're doing a very gentle visualization. But also in the beginning, you don't have to do the visualization. It can be helpful for some people and also not so helpful for other people. And then we're bringing the breath, and then we're inhaling it to this place here. Obviously, it's filling our lungs, but we can push it into this area about 4 fingers below the navel. Yeah? And then we hold it there as long as we can. And then before we're out of breath, we release it. And we repeat that over and over. Yeah? So that's, it's very simple. That's the gentle God's breath. We're going to also learn something called the nine-round breathing, which is a way to purify the channels before engaging in the gentle God's breath. It's very simple. You purify the right channel, the left channel, and then the central channel. So more or less, I don't want to get too complicated with the, because the subtle body stuff can get really complicated in Tibetan Buddhism, so I'm not here to do that. I'm more here to, you don't need to know much to actually get health. Does that make sense? Okay, you don't need a lot of information. If you're a yogi trying to get, you know, high Vajrayana realizations, then you need a lot of information. So maybe eventually you guys, if you're interested in that, you can get teachings on that. But I will tell you about the channel system. So in general, you have, probably you guys know this because it's similar in yogic, you know, Vedic traditions, things like that. So you have a right channel, a left channel, and then a central channel. Yeah? And so the central channel basically goes from forefinger width below the navel, in front of the spine, and then comes up around to here. And then the right channel comes down, and then comes right near the central channel, and then the left channel like that. Now these channels also have interaction with, correlation to emotional patterns. So I think I got it right, but usually the right channel is anger, associated with anger in men, and then attachment, the left channel is associated with more attachment. And then the central channel can be associated with ignorance. But these also have their pure aspects too. So the central channel is associated with wisdom, but a non-dual type of, non-conceptual type of wisdom. Yeah? So that's it. I'm going to say more. So anyway, so the nine-round breathing is purifying these channels. So you're sort of preparing them then for the gentle Vajra breath. So the result of doing the gentle Vajra breath over time, and it has to be done fairly regularly, it can be done throughout the day, is balanced lung. The lung will end up settling more here, or the winds will settle here, and then we have to kind of lock it here. So eventually that'll happen, but it does take some effort. Some people don't have success with this, but in my own case, it's been successful to a certain degree, but I have to do very regular practice every day. Yeah? So generally how to practice it daily is to just do it 20 minutes. You can do it 10 minutes if you like, whatever kind of time you have. And if you see the benefit, you'll see it actually working and you're going to want to do it more. You could also do it throughout the day. You don't have to sit and do it. Yeah? So maybe I'll show you how to do it right now, and then we'll take a break and come back and like actually do more. So the nine-round breathing, there's many ways to do this. Have any of you studied in Tibetan Buddhism before and gotten teaching the nine-round breathing? No? Okay. You have? Okay. There's many different ways to do this. I'm going to teach you more of a simple way. So for women, you want to start on the left side. For men, we're going to start on the right. And so what you do is, just real simply, you can cover. So I'm going to cover my left, but it'd be opposite for women, yeah? And you'd start by first inhale with both nostrils. Then just exhale. Then you close one nostril. You can close it with your thumb or whatever's comfortable. Then inhale once through the right. Very gently when you're inhaling. And then when you're ready to exhale, you exhale a little bit in the beginning, and then it becomes more forceful. So if you watch me, it's a little like this. Like this, yeah? So at the end, I'm being more forceful. And then I'm exhaling. Yeah? Then you'd switch, and then you cover the next one with your the ring finger. Yeah? And you inhale through the left, or right if you're a woman. And then exhale. then we're going to end in L through bold.
Do you have to be forceful?
You don't have to. If it's, you can just do it. It's both of them gently if you want. Some ways they teach it, they do both gently.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's up to you. Inhaling through both nostrils. Then you can rest for a second. Just rest in your body. Yeah?
Do 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, or keep to one side for one.
There's different ways to do it. I think just the simple way is you can keep to one side. Yeah, you 3 on this, in and out, 3 on this, in and out, and then 3, both, yeah. Then the Vaz breath itself. Then you start the Vaz breath. And this is through both nostrils. You can keep, you want to sit with your back straight, like in meditation posture. You can do however you want, if it's comfortable to hold your hands here on your lap or just on your knees. And then you inhale through both nostrils. And then there's sort of a subtle visualization happening here where as you inhale, you're inhaling it coming down. And then you're pressing very gently with your, I think it's your diaphragm. So you're pressing very gently down with your diaphragm. But you're breathing into this area, four finger widths below the navel. What's very helpful in the beginning is to touch this area. So in the beginning, breathe out, touch this area, and then breathe out through your nostrils. And you feel it going in, yeah? Then breathe into your fingertip. And then you just hold it. But don't breathe it so full, about 70% full. Hold it. You should, at the beginning you might not be able to talk, but I'm holding it right now and I can still talk a little bit. And then when it's comfortable, exhale. And then what helps is to suck in your gut here a little bit. Yeah? And breathe in then. Now this can be quite difficult at first. Because often the winds are stuck up here and up here. So it's difficult to even breathe down here. But you just keep going. So let's practice this for a few minutes, yeah? Do you guys have the technique down? Is there any questions about the technique? Yeah.
Can I just say something that might be helpful for people? Just the anatomy of your diaphragm, since that's what we're really working with.
You've got a doctor here.
Yeah. So the diaphragm is like a dome. It's a muscle that separates your belly from your lungs, and it's like a dome. And when you breathe, there are muscles attached to your spine and ribs that come down. So when you breathe in, you're actually sort of inverting it like an umbrella, that's come flat. And so the only way that you can really take a full breath is to put your belly out. And a lot of us don't breathe that way. When we take a deep breath in, we go,
exactly.
And we bring the belly in. So you've got to be willing, when you take that full breath in, you've got to really be willing to let the belly get big. And so that will allow you to bring that lung
exactly.
down.
Exactly. Yeah, if you breathe, 1 second. If you breathe, actually it's dangerous. If you do this meditation and you're breathing into your chest, like you said, breathing up here, it's going to increase the winds in that area. So you have to really, be really gentle, really spacious with this, yeah? Just really try to, like I said, if you suck in your gut and then push out a little bit, like Bruce is saying, it helps.
Does the breath originate in the nose, or does it originate down here as well?
The physical breath, I think, is the lungs, yeah, and the nose, and the mouth, yeah. But then this is kind of, it's a little bit interesting. Thanks for actually saying that. I'll bring up another point. The winds, as far as the subtle body winds, or prana, they relate with the actual physical wind, you know, of air. Yeah. They relate with that. It's not the exact, it's not the same thing, but they have this correlation. So when we're working with our breath, it has an effect on that subtle wind. Does that make sense? Actually, sort of the manifestation of the subtle wind is the gross wind of air. So they have this real correlation. That's why you see so much breath work in meditation and yoga, hatha yoga. It's really trying to affect the subtle body. One thing I also wanted to mention too is working with the breath through the nose, you're working with what's called the karmic winds. So these are the winds that are sort of habitual patterns. So by working with that breath through the nose, we're slowly purifying them. We're slowly sort of, and by purifying, it's sort of, I think, like, alchemy is a better word. You know what I mean? It's more an alchemical process. Yeah. So any meditations we're doing today, you can choose however you like. If you want to keep your eyes open. For this, you can also close your eyes fully. For some of the meditations later, I'm going to ask you to keep your eyes open, at least a little bit. But for this, you can close your eyes if you'd like. So just take a second to sort of find a home in your body. If you don't have a home in your body, you can use the certain parts as a focus. Like I said, your solar plexus, your dantian, maybe your feet, your knees. The reason I'm not saying the head is often we're using that as our focus point because we usually equate the mind with the brain. And often that can bring the womb high by focusing on that. So we're going to focus on the lower part of the body. I personally like to focus on just the body as a whole and sort of feeling the whole entire body. Just rest. Relax into your body. Whatever you're feeling, pain, discomfort, bliss, anxiety. Let it be. Let it be what it is. Allow yourself to fully immerse in your experience. If it's a good feeling, something that we associate with pleasure, grasp at it. If it's an unpleasant feeling, don't try to reject it. Just be with it. Right now we're not using so much mindfulness, we're just merely resting in the body. Just allowing it to be. This is actually a real practice of relaxation. body, actually our wind, our loom will settle naturally, even without doing the gentle lodge breath. So next we can bring a little mindfulness in. We don't have to bring mindfulness in as sort of some dictator officiating over the whole situation. More like a parent at a barbecue. Just hang out, drink a beer. But he's watching his kid too. If we bring the mindfulness too strongly in this practice, we may increase the loom into areas we don't want it in. So here we're just being a witness. So continuing to rest in our body, create more relaxation, more ease, more openness, spaciousness. But we're not trying to force that. If we feel like shit, just feel like shit. Who cares? That's the sort of attitude. Just let it be what it is. So next we can start to use our mindfulness to very gently recognize any sort of patterns in our emotional experience and also our nervous system. We may feel a little bit speedy, like we feel like we have to go somewhere or do something. We may have thoughts racing through our mind. We may have pressure or pain in certain areas of the body, fogginess in our head. We may also maybe have bliss or feel a lot of ease and spaciousness. Whatever the feeling. We just merely recognize it. It also might take some time to begin to recognize the sort of effects of how the winds are moving. This is the kind of subtle body intelligence that starts to happen. After we practice meditation on a regular basis, we start to be aware of when our loom, our winds, are interacting in certain areas of the body. We start to become aware of certain emotional patterns based off of our winds moving. And then we leave. receive a lot of space and gentleness. Often with clarity comes judgment. But part of this meditation is practicing mindfulness and clarity, being aware, being cognizant, gaining some emotional intelligence, subtle body intelligence, but really working with the judger, especially the attitude that we actually have to do something with this, or not do something, or reject it. We're just sitting, merely being aware. And the kindness to it is giving it space to be what it is. Whatever emotion, sensation is happening, that's the kindness to the feeling or emotion. And the kindness to ourselves is not following it. This comes from submission. So now you can open your eyes if you need to look at me. We're still going to meditate. We're going to start the 9-round breathing. So for women, you close your right nostril with your right thumb. For men, you're going to close your left nostril with your left thumb. And inhale really gently into this area. Then exhale gently. Beginning. And more forceful if you want. Inhale one more time through the same nostril. Exhale. One more time. Then you can close your other nostril with the ring finger. Last one, inhaling through both nostrils, I'm going to teach you a very simple visualization. So you can visualize rainbow light coming in from all directions. This light is filled with blessings and healing energy. You inhale through both nostrils. The light comes in, up through your channel, and then down here to the navel area. And then when you exhale, you exhale black smoke. And it comes out of all your pores, out of your nostrils. It dispels all obstacles, health issues, everything. Subtle body problems. So we'll inhale 2 more times with that visualization. Inhale and exhale. Inhale. And exhale. More forceful at the end if you'd like. You can do it gentle too. Now just take a second, before we engage in the gentle Vaz breath, just take a second to just rest in your body again. Feel the kind of space the 9-round breathing creates. Usually you'll feel a little bit more clarity in your head. You can think a little clearer. them. Inhale really gently through both nostrils. And you can visualize sort of like a candy cane. So the air is coming in and then down. And then you can visualize like a coffee press. This is what Sobhnir Rinpoche uses as an aid. Like a coffee press, pressing the subtle energy down to this area. Yeah? And when you inhale, four finger widths below the navel, just hold it really gently there. Don't push. And when you're ready, exhale. Suck in your belly a little bit. And repeat the same thing. And do this coffee press visualization. Sometimes it even helps me to use my hands, so I'll do this. I'm exhaling now, and I'm going to inhale. And then, as you're holding it here below your navel, also focus your mindfulness there. So this is where the continuation of our mindfulness of body meditation comes. So we continue this, but our mindfulness is here. And don't push yourself to hold it for too long. Just breathe. Just hold it as naturally as you can. Breathe out when you need to. You probably won't be able to hold it very long at first. But with more practice, get to 20, 30, 40 seconds. One of my teachers can hold this for 15 minutes, but that's sort of a kind of an attainment. So maybe don't go for that right now. You might pass out. Also working with the diaphragm takes a little bit of practice. Getting the right amount of pressure, but if we push too hard, what can happen is it can trigger the balloon to actually go back up. So we don't want to push with a huge, huge amount. So just keep repeating this. We'll meditate for a few minutes. So the meditation object here is our breath. It's also being mindful of the area four fingers width below the navel. Putting our attention there. Like I said, we can bring our finger down there if it's helpful. And make sure you're breathing in this area, way down deep here. Some signs that the winds are starting to settle there. Your stomach might start to growl or make noises. You might get more gas in the lower area. Also, your chest area might start to feel more spacious, like suddenly your chest feels this big, or your head might start to clear. These are all signs that the winds are starting to go down and settle here. I venture to say that 70% of our emotional difficulties come from having wind imbalances, if not close to 100%. Once we get the winds balanced here, a lot of anxiety, stress, depression dissipate. But it takes time and effort, intention, mindful awareness. Very difficult to relate to our emotions because we're boxed in. Our emotions sort of corner us. But when we get some spaciousness in our subtle body and our more physical body, much easier to relate to emotions and thoughts. We start to gain well-being in our physical and emotional center. Little tip to this method also is while you're holding the breath, forefinger width below the navel, you can take little sips of air through your nostrils. So if you're running out of breath, you can just refill it, and then you're actually able to hold it longer. So you can try that now. Once you've inhaled, brought it to your navel area. Push down the diaphragm a little bit gently. Take a sip. This is why in the beginning we only fill it about 70%. So when we take these sips, it fills it the rest of the way right before we exhale. Also, we kind of refresh our Ba's breath with those. After we get some health in the subtle body through bringing down the moon or the winds through the space breath, gentle Ba's breath, after time and repeating this exercise every day, we'll start to have more balance in our subtle body. And then a sense of basic okayness within our emotional center. Now you can let go of the breath for a little while, the lost breath. Just simply go back to resting in your body, being mindful of your sensations and trying to gain some inner knowledge, emotional, feeling knowledge of the subtle body. Just take note how you feel. You only did it for a short time, but is there some openness where there wasn't before? Is there more tightness? Is there more of a feeling of well-being? Calmness? So you can slowly open your eyes. So is there any questions? Questions about the practice, or
could you explain again the exhale of the last breath?
The exhale, yeah, that's just real, just gentle. Thank you. Yeah, so when you're coming up, you're still kind of holding your mindfulness here. So even though there's nothing coming, you don't want to bring your lung back up because you want it to stay here. Like 70% of it you want here. Usually it's excessive in this area, right? So when we're exhaling, we're sucking in the belly, for the next breath. But at the same time, what really helps is holding some mindfulness there. If you start being mindful, if you start bringing your mindfulness up, it's going to bring the lung up. So the lung, mind or thought and lung ride on each other. So they sort of, so when you think where the lung is going to go, it will go there. If you think enough on your shoulder, you'll end up with quite a bit of it in your shoulder, most likely. So keep the mindfulness there, but suck in your belly.
I notice now, and I've noticed before, there's a lot of kind of physical tension on the right side of my body. Mm. So I'm wondering with the right and left channels, if there's a way to work with that?
The 9-round breathing.
Okay.
Yeah, you keep doing that. That's going to balance the winds in those channels, sort of clean it.
So when you're breathing in, like through the left nostril, do you think of it going on your left side, or is it just your breathing? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can do that. I didn't give the visualization so much for the 9-round breathing because I didn't want to complicate it too much.
Yeah.
But the simple way is to do what I did for both nostrils. So you can visualize rainbow light either as separate lights, or I like to visualize it as like, you know, like a Twizzler.
Yeah.
My teacher said you can do it like that too. It's sort of twisted together, and they're the five, you know, rainbow, five colors of the rainbow. Or there's five or anyways. Seven, yeah, rainbow colors. And then they sort of go in there in your nostril, and then they come into your channel there, and then they go down into your navel area here. And then they sort of, you're keeping it there. And then when you exhale, you're exhaling black smoke, all these kind of nasty things. Sometimes they have like, you can exhale like snakes, frogs, things like that. Anything kind of, not people, you know, that are icky, right? And that's all the sort of obstacles, health obstacles, obstacles to our emotions, thought patterns, to our spiritual practice, all of that sort of gets expelled.
So just to verify, then when I'm breathing in the right, that's when I'm coming up the right side, and when I'm breathing in the left nostril, that's when I'm coming up the
left
side.
Yeah, for the visualization.
And then the
yeah.
both one is when it's coming down the middle.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
And then sometimes when I'm doing that, I hold it in, and if I do that a couple times, I start to get dizzy. So is it because I'm breathing
yeah.
too shallow or too deep, or I haven't practiced enough?
No, thanks for that. What you're going to have to do is really be gentle, and then practice getting the breathing down here. So usually when you get dizzy, it's because the air is being held up here. Mm-hmm. It could be something else, but generally the air is we're holding the lung too much up here, and it's actually going to the head. Mm-hmm. So then stop, maybe. Mm-hmm. Or just go really gentle. Maybe you can start by not holding it, just breathing into that area, like inhaling into this area. And directly exhaling. Do that for a few minutes and see what. Mm-hmm. But the dizziness, don't keep pushing if the right. dizziness is happening.
And the lung, define it quickly. That's not the prana one. The lung is.
Yeah.
The
so the lung. Sorry, I'm kind of interchanging the words. So lung, prana, and what do you call it? Wind.
Okay.
Wind is synonymous.
Yeah. Are you saying wind as in W-I-N-D?
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be kind of the loose English translation of it. Because yeah. lung in Tibetan can also, lung is a Tibetan word, it can also mean like, it can actually mean physical air too. So it has a lot of different meanings. Yeah. But whatever helps. I can use the English term if you guys prefer. This one, you know, they're sort of interchangeable in my mind. Anybody have any experience they'd like to talk about or... no experience. This is a practice that takes a while. It's not fast. So definitely quick results is not something to look for. But if you practice it for 10 or 20 minutes, I think most people notice a difference if you get the breath right. Yeah? I mean, even just doing breathing in and out without holding the breath, you're going to feel a difference, no?
Yeah. I think that working with the lung has made a huge difference.
Yeah.
And just even the awareness that is connected to what feels like emotional discomfort.
Exactly, yeah.
And just having it stay here is a real settling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think there's something that gets caught for me when there's the idea of doing it right and doing it wrong.
Yes.
And I noticed that when we kind of officially stopped the exercise, the breathing became really like effortless
yeah.
and
yeah.
lovely, and it was doing itself.
Yeah.
And during the guided meditation, there was some like, subtle struggle happening, and I don't know if you have any.
Yeah, I mean, that's. Yeah, that's. Our Western habitual pattern. You know, I have the same thing. I think it comes from a need to have things very like regimented and sort of black and white. And then this isn't personal, by the way. Because I experienced the same thing, very black and white. And then, what's really good about
Now I have to, I don't want to, but I have to bring in cultural things here because otherwise we're not going to be aware of how they affect us. But I don't necessarily want to attack these. You see what I'm saying? Because there's so many beautiful things about our culture as well. Like the beautiful aspect is we're really good at putting things together. You know what I mean? So if you go to Nepal, somebody in Rinpoche really likes to use this example, but I'm going to steal it because I was just there. So I, you know, personal experience. Nothing really works. Like, I mean, I'm really surprised that actually, like, things don't just run into each other all the time. Lots of, you know, it manages to, like, just miss, like, you know, the cars are like this, they're about to hit, but then they go like this, you know? And then the power's off, you know, like 12 hours a day. The sanitation sort of okay. It's getting better. But not so good at that kind of aspect, you know? The cognitive ability to put A and B and, you know, make C or whatever, right? So we're extremely good at that in our modern Western culture, but almost too good. So what it does is it creates a drive, or I'm going to use it. This is a really good segue, so thanks for bringing this up, because we're going to talk about habitual patterns next. So this creates a habitual pattern where it's very easy to get stuck in a method, you know, and then needing to be so regimented within a method that then the method doesn't work because there's anxiety and, you know what I mean, pushiness around the method. But at the same time, we do need clarity, right? We need clarity on, okay, how does this work? But often, I mean, Jill, we had a nice conversation last night. I'm gonna take from what Jill said. You know, often we don't like being confused. You know, it's really difficult in our culture to be confused. And but what Jill was pointing out last night is there's a lot of beauty and openness and things to learn from when you're confused. Yeah. And there's sort of a space of having this open question, you know. So, I would say that's more the remedy. You know, having this kind of open mentality where, okay, I think I got it right, but then just letting it be gentle. Another remedy I use, because I have the same issue, is really relaxing first. You know what I mean? Letting that, like, maybe you have to spend more time resting in the body, and then really letting that natural relaxation come. And then you start this. But also it's like familiarization. It's like when you're learning to do anything, I think, that's new, it's a little, you know what I mean? The inner workings. I think it took me a good few weeks to get this breath down. And still sometimes my lung is too high, and so it's difficult to breathe down there some days, you know? So it's really, what do you call it? It's really a... like, you really got to work with it, and it's different every day you show up. Just like doing, you know, meditation on the breath or any other kind of thing. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah, it's a skill. But yeah, I think, so yeah, those are the three aspects. One is just getting more familiar with it. The second is sort of this habitual pattern that we have, loosening that a little bit. Just, you know, the whole reason I bring it up and all these kind of things we'll talk about today is because if we know that the habitual pattern is going on, now this is something for you to, you have to personally discover this. I can't tell you. You know what I'm saying? You have to investigate your mind, your life, as we all do, and figure out, okay, what are my specific habitual patterns? Without a lot of judgment, without a lot of, God, why did I do this? Or what? You know what I mean? There has to be a lot of gentleness, a lot of openness. I think this is where then the third aspect of what Jill was saying of being okay with being confused comes in. Because when we're okay with sort of being confused and not knowing the answer to everything, then there's space for gentleness. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. There's like an open kind of gentleness there. So yeah. So one good aspect is we're able to make buildings that will not fall down in an earthquake. Like in Nepal, man, I really don't want to be there in an earthquake. I really feel bad. I mean, a lot of the buildings are just going to fall. A lot of people will die. It's really sad. I hope there's never an earthquake. But here we're really good at that kind of thing. But then we sit there and worry about an earthquake all day. You see? Even though we just built a building where it's not going to fall on us, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's kind of ridiculous when you think about it. Well, it is ridiculous. So, but really our job as meditators and just human beings who want to help the world, you know? I mean, I think that's, in a way, we come to meditation practice in order to help mitigate our own emotional experience, our own experience with our life. But I think deep down, we have altruistic, you know, most human beings have an altruism, you know, the wish to benefit others in some kind of way. So I think through sort of keeping an open question, then a lot of the anxiety goes down, you know? So it's kind of, you know, yeah. I don't know. I mean, your question brought up more, so that's why I'm speaking.
Not really helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, yeah. And it leads really well into what I was going to ask. Good job.
I did it right.
You did it right. Exactly.
That's good.
So, what was I going to say? Yeah, so this method, some people can't relate to this method. I learned this from Sokhi Rinpoche, but I've also learned it in other contexts with other teachers. But some people have a hard time relating to this. They don't feel it working, or it is for some people difficult to breathe into this area, really, because we're so used to breathing very shallowly. Yeah, like Bruce was saying, you know, we're so used to that kind of breath because that's the breath of anxiety, speediness, overworking our bodies and minds. All of that is this kind of breath, just breathing here, you know. So this kind of breath, I mean, that's why I think hatha yoga is so helpful for people, because they do this, they're breathing down here a lot of the time. Yeah, I think it depends on the kind of yoga, but mostly here. So it might take some time, that's my point. So just be, if it's something that you want to try, which I'm highly recommending, it's really helped me, but it took 6 months, a good 6 months. And then I still have days where I get up in the morning. I usually do it on an empty stomach, so I do it right before breakfast. It's a little easier on an empty stomach because it's easier to breathe into that area. It's very difficult when you're full. But you don't have to do it on an empty stomach. I just find it more useful. And and I do it first thing in the morning for about 20 minutes. But I think it doesn't have to be regimented. You could just do it until you feel some spaciousness. But it takes time to really... It's easy to get the lung to go down. Like some of you just doing it for... We did it 10 or 15 minutes. Some of you may have already felt a little bit of openness, a little bit of spaciousness. I don't know. You could say so if you did. A little bit of spaciousness in this area, in your head, a little bit more clarity, a little bit more calmness. But then getting it to stay down there is more difficult. That's a long-term process. So getting it to go down can take 15, 20 minutes, but then it'll go back up again when our habitual pattern triggers it. Yeah? Because just like we create habitual patterns with our thoughts, with our emotional responses, the way we were raised, the way we were educated, also our subtle body has habitual patterns. You see? So it has certain circles that it tends to go through in the body, and then we repeat that behavior, it triggers an emotion, and then that repeats the behavior, and then it keeps repeating over and over and over and over again. So it becomes sort of like mini samsaras. You know, many sort of cycles within our subtle body. Yeah.
Something that is interesting is that this can be brought into everyday activity. And actually, mm-hmm. for me, I think that I was able to feel that lowering of the lung in activity, almost mm-hmm. you know, not complicated activity,
yeah.
but walking, running, things like that. I could. It was easier to sense an openness and a spaciousness doing that than almost in sitting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, so you guys might have to play with it a little bit, you know, see how it, exactly, you might have to apply it in daily life, yeah.
And my thought, similar to that, is that I can see practicing it in the morning, and then I'm out during the day, and something triggers me.
Yeah.
And is it, I know about coming to my breath, would it be, is it something where then I would really visualize if I'm standing in the store or mm-hmm. driving, I go to here, mm-hmm. I drop. So I want to practice dropping to that. Or is that something that just couldn't, you do it in the morning and just kind of, you know, after a while it just kind of becomes part of you.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about that okay. next. I'm going to give another exercise to apply during the day, but also what Jill is saying, So Nubeshe advises too, you can actually do this breath while you're in the supermarket, while you're working. You don't have to be sitting in meditation, but what I've helped, like for instance with most things, you know, I'm sure some of you have a daily meditation practice, so I'm sure you've noticed as you sit for 20, 30, whatever minutes a day in the morning, it does affect the rest of your day. So that's why I'm advising to do a little bit in the morning, because for most of us it will create a habitual pattern for them that will affect the rest of the day. But yeah, you might have to, you can do it throughout the rest of the day. You can also, often for me it's difficult to breathe sometimes when I'm in an activity, it's difficult to, you know, like do the whole thing I was explaining, so when I'm walking. So Nimshe said he can actually, so I think you can once you get more advanced at it. But what I do is I keep my mindfulness here, so that's one way, just keeping my kind of center of my grounding of my body in this area. And then the other way is what I'm going to talk about next. So because the subtle body and emotions and thought patterns are all correlated, also we can affect the subtle body with how we're relating to our emotions. Yeah? So once we get some, once the this breath, gentle body breath, can sort of be like a lifesaver in a way, because it gives us like a, sometimes when we just directly try to apply some kind of psychological techniques or mindfulness techniques or emotional sort of using thought to affect the emotion, sometimes it's very difficult to get those to penetrate if the lung or winds are too high. So by doing this breath, it gives some space where then when we apply techniques of mindfulness to the emotions, sort of techniques of thinking, okay, I don't, you know, being aware of what thought patterns we have, aware of what emotions are coming up, and then using a method with those, it by having the lung down here, it allows so much space and ability to then actually have those be successful. Does that make sense? Because often there's so much lung and anxiety or whatever we're dealing with that it's very difficult to have an effect on the emotion. Because the emotions, they come up very strong and they're very persistent, yeah? So, basically what we're trying to get to is, Sunim Shay likes to use the term healthy human being, and I think this is a really nice term. It's sort of, healthy human being sort of incorporates a lot of aspects, but more or less what this is referring to is not just physical health, but emotional health. And this health of having what he calls it essence love, but I'm going to use the term like basic okayness. So eventually what we want is a center of sort of basic okayness. And this is our emotional center. So our emotional center comes from this. And basic okayness or essence love or well-being are all sort of synonymous terminology in regards to this. And they're more or less, this refers to sort of, we've all felt this, but we rarely feel this, I think. You know? This refers to this feeling when we don't, there's no condition there. That there's no condition that we're relying on to make us happy, or to make us feel sort of joy, or just feel spaciousness, or well-being. Yeah? There's no coffee, there's no partner, there's no movie, there's no satisfaction from work or satisfaction from a hobby or sport. We just feel like, oh, okay, I'm okay, you know, and we could just sit there and be okay. I mean, of course we're going to need to eat and drink at a certain point, right? I'm not talking about that. But so that's what this basic okayness is. So this is what we want as the basis of our emotional center. Now, as you can see in the world, this is becoming a rare commodity at this point, right? But it's really a misunderstanding of how our emotional body works, including, and by emotional body, I mean also subtle body, what I just explained. That's the whole reason I have to explain subtle body to lead into this, because it's so much of our experience. So it's sort of like if you have a tree encroaching on your house, and you know, every year it encroaches and threatens to break windows and things like that. You can chop off branches, you know, but in regards to healthy human being having a healthy emotional base, eventually it's better to cut the root, So the root is working more with the subtle body in this mm-hmm. sense, right? So okayness and well-being has to be based off of a balanced subtle body. So then, working with emotional patterns. So this is the process of, we have to have some sort of semblance of mindfulness. This is where I think using methods from Buddhism can really help. So we have a daily practice of watching our breath or whatever, mindfulness of body, whatever our meditation is. This actually grows our mindfulness and makes it stronger and stronger. So then throughout the day, we're able to recognize what kind of emotion is coming. We're able to recognize what kind of thought pattern is coming. Sometimes it's very difficult if we're in a situation that's intense. Usually for me, it's family. Family, yeah. So, you know, sometimes emotions can come where the habitual pattern is so strong that it just, boom, and, you know, anger or whatever is there. So I'm going to explain habitual pattern a little bit, just so there's some clarity around that, because I keep mentioning that word. So within Buddha Dharma, we have two ways of explaining habitual pattern. The word in Tibetan is called bhakchak, but usually they're focusing on one type of habitual pattern, which is karmic habitual patterns, right? So I'm just going to explain this. If you guys aren't necessarily religious, it's okay. You can just take it as information. You don't have to believe what I'm saying is, I'm not pushing this on you. So from a Buddhist perspective, the karmic pattern is coming from, karma just really simply just means action. You know, it's just very simple. So it's coming from an action that we've created. And then that action actually created a certain pattern that usually they're referring to a past life. So then that karmic pattern was created, but we're also creating them every moment in this life. You see? So that's the more subtle form of habitual pattern. The karmic pattern. Now the karmic pattern affects habitual patterns that are just what we call habitual patterns of this life. So those are things, the way we were raised, what kind of food we were given, what kind of education we had, all that, right? So the question, I don't think we have to think so much, okay, well, what's karmic pattern, what's habitual pattern? We just can deal with it. But I think knowing that there's these two kinds of patterns is very helpful. Because often what people like to do is just work with the habitual pattern. So here, actually, the techniques I'm teaching right now in the morning, these are just working with the habitual patterns of this life. We're not working so much with karmic habitual patterns. But within Buddha Dharma, eventually you have to hit the karmic habitual pattern. So that's why they have all these methods in practice within the Buddha Dharma to hit the karmic pattern, to actually purify or cleanse that karmic pattern. So then the karmic pattern doesn't affect us anymore. And then slowly, that leads to more to Buddha. So I'm going to talk about that in the afternoon. But right now it's just the habitual patterns of this life. So we need mindfulness throughout the day to just recognize what kind of... So we were doing this meditation of resting in the body, and I asked you guys, really try and note what's happening, right? Use mindfulness to note not just the physical sensations, but the sensations in your nervous system. Like this example of the clapper and the gong, right? So really noticing, where's that sound coming from, right? So for me, I said usually there's a lot of... there can be pressure here. Often when I do this face breathing and this, there's some space that comes and the loom goes down. The way I can tell is there's a little bit of tingliness that happens. Like, it's hard to explain. Like your foot's coming back awake after being asleep, mm-hmm. but not painful. Kind of pleasure. It's a little bit of good feeling. Pleasant. And then open and then space. So that's how I know the loom is going down. So after you practice this more and more, you'll be able to be aware of those situations, and you're gaining some intelligence of the subtle body, but it's not a cognitive intelligence. It's an intelligence based off of feeling. You see what I'm saying? So it's a different way of approaching this, because usually we're used to using cognitive ability, like just thinking, okay, I know this. But actually we have very little awareness and intelligence on the emotional and feeling level. Yeah? So this is something we have to change. If we want to affect and have more emotional well-being have this basic sense of okayness, like I was saying, eventually we have to gain more intelligence in this kind of arena. So once we've done that, and once we're also able to have some mindfulness, so throughout the day we're able to recognize, okay, well, this is kind of anger coming. This is or aversion, you could say. This is kind of attachment or grasping at this. This is jealousy coming. Whatever the emotion is. I think the first step is just meeting that. See? So now I'm going to give you guys some techniques to work with these. Either you can use the lung practice, the base breathing practice, or you can use these techniques. Now often what I find is you have to use these techniques of meeting the emotion or meeting the thought pattern and being very open and gentle with this. And then this technique combined with the Vaz breath in the morning or throughout the day, they work in tandem. You see? So what do we do? So, you know, some really difficult, shitty emotion comes, you know, we don't want, we're having a good day, and then suddenly, you know, if we have the awareness to even realize it's not this a-hole who just made me feel this way. You see what I'm saying? So often, usually we're blaming. Usually we're saying, oh, my partner or my boss or whatever made me feel this way, or this guy on the road did this. But actually, yeah, they're a condition. But then really, where's the emotion happening? So we have to have, and like I said, you know, it's difficult. So we have to, I think, first we have to work with situations that we can do this in where the emotion's not so strong. Yeah? I mean, sometimes I like working with this with music and sort of that kind of thing, or I'll go to an area, like a public area, and I don't have so much attachment or aversion to the people because I don't know them. So then, and I'll just watch them, and then there's certain like emotions that come. Sometimes I have a lot of attachment and aversion, so it just depends. So you have to find a situation where there's the emotions aren't so strong, and then you can really just sit and use mindfulness and recognize them coming. First, you can use maybe some more techniques from the Theravada, where I think you just recognize them. You can note them. You know, learn to be familiar with them. But you don't, the thing is, we're not becoming like a judger of these, and we're not repressing these. That's the very difficult part. We're so used to repressing and sort of then engaging. So the sort of remedy to repression is to just meet it. So you sort of like, Sogyal Rinpoche likes to say, you shake hands with it. So you're sort of meeting it like a friend, and then you're handshaking it. Somebody says. I like this analogy because it's pretty accurate when you get this sort of technique down. Another kind of mantra Sogyal Rinpoche likes to use is real but not true. So this is a really beautiful one. That's why I'm stealing from him and using it here. When an emotion, a pattern comes, emotional pattern or habitual thought pattern comes, and it's a string of thoughts, you can think to yourself, this is real, it's happening. So there you're meeting it, right? So you're not denying it. You're saying, okay, this is actually happening in my mind, in my feelings, my subtle body, my emotional body, and then you meet it, and it's real, but it's not true. So this not true part, we're going to get into more in the afternoon. This relates to the Buddhist concept of emptiness. But actually, you don't have to think of emptiness. You can make it much more simple. Why is it not true? Because it's not in relationship with how the actual phenomena is working. You know, there's sort of a, it could be based off of our sort of interpretation of it, but it could not be. I mean, Rinpoche likes to tell, if you get his book, he likes to tell a story of him on a bridge where the bridge was very, very safe, but he had a habitual pattern with heights. So it was really difficult for him to walk over the bridge, but actually the bridge was safe. So it was real, the emotion was real, his habitual pattern was real, but it wasn't true that the bridge was unsafe. Now if the bridge is unsafe, then you could say that's true to a certain extent. But of course in Buddhist philosophy we'd argue that as well. How much truth is there, you know? So that's the afternoon. I'm not going to get into that now.
What if it's a more generalized kind of habitual feeling like fear or anxiety?
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to. What about it, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you, basically the technique is to, first you have to have some kind of mindfulness to even just be aware of that, right? Because usually what's happening is the emotion comes and we're immediately like grabbing on and then going with that, you know, and then it just takes us here and there and everywhere. So you have to have some mindfulness where first baby mindfulness is going to be like, definitely we're going to grasp onto that and it's going to take us, but the mindfulness is going to be more like this. So you could sit there and, you know, and then you're grasping onto it. You're believing it's you, but at the same time, there's some space where you're not being led around by it. That's baby mindfulness. Eventually more space comes. Yeah? So we have to have that mindfulness first. And then the second moment is to have this attitude of real but not true, and we're just meeting it. See? So there's no sort of judgment. There's no sort of like, oh, this is bad. This is good. This is something I should get rid of. This is something I should adopt. We're just merely just handshaking with it. Does that make sense? So that's the first step, yeah? So this is kind of... So really what this leads to is there's no rejection of our momentary experience. But there's also no... We're not following it either. So remember during the guided meditation, I said, you know, come on in, yeah. The kindness is... the kindness to the emotion or thought pattern is allowing it to be what it is. But then the kindness to ourselves is not following it. Mm-hmm. So this is another really important step to remember. So really it's meeting it and then giving the kindness to it. You know, because I think the emotion, it wants to express itself, you know. It doesn't want to be, squashed. So I think when you give it some space, eventually the emotion sort of is like, oh, okay. It's sort of like, maybe it doesn't work in all cases, but like a really rowdy kid or something. Like Tibetan kids, they let their kids just run and yell, and I'm always like, why aren't they trying to do something with them? You know, but actually when they get to be adults, they're quite calm. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like they let they let things express itself how it's going to express, and then at a certain point that expression just changes, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a really allowing but not not rejecting the experience, but then so you're allowing but then you're not adopting either. Yeah, that's very difficult. Usually it's very easy with anger. Most of us do not like anger. You know, I don't think any of us in this room like anger. You know, we can go to another room and probably find people who like anger. I don't know if Santa Cruz is up, maybe. No, I think we can.
Before you have anger.
It's passive aggression.
What is it?
It's passive aggression.
Yeah. So you can find a lot of that. But generally most people don't like anger because immediately it doesn't make us feel good, you know? And if we've studied some spiritual teaching or Buddhism, you know, they say, oh, anger is bad, blah, 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 you know. So we immediately want to reject it. So with anger, it's not so difficult to not grasp at it, but what's difficult is to not reject it. By not rejecting it, it doesn't mean you get angry either. It doesn't mean you have permission to go off on someone, you know. It means you just let it be what it is. And again, if it's, like I said, working with emotions that aren't as intense is more helpful in the beginning. And then usually it's quite easy, like, oh, there's that chocolate I really like. very easy to not reject that, you know, and very easy to also grab it and grasp on it. So that's very tricky. Often this is sort of a little bit of once people practice Buddhism a little bit, quite a bit, myself included, and then in the West, it's very easy to like not get angry and work with emotions that are sort of negative, but then attachment, very difficult to work with. We just still want to go for the pleasure. Yeah, this is also going to be an afternoon, but I'm sort of bringing it up right now because it's important. We have to start. We have to relate to things, and it's there's neutrality. I wanted to talk about what you said earlier. There's neutrality. But there's also like aliveness. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. You know, so like especially from my tradition, there's a way of engaging with emotions where you're really fully engaging with it. It's almost like you're just like wow, look at this. Look at this kind of like display, you see? And then you're engaging with it fully. But you're engaging it in first with this kind of mindfulness, then later with more techniques where you're trying to relate to its essence, which is something you can't actually find if you try to look for it. And then that kind of space opens up. And then the energy of that emotion can then express itself. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's a little, I'm being a little vague now, but hopefully later on it'll become more clear. So neutrality might be really helpful in the beginning, but eventually we have to be careful because sometimes neutrality can be a subtle kind of rejection. Yeah. That's what I was thinking about. So the kindness to the emotion is allowing the kindness to you is not wrong. So I think this is really good to remember. Yeah. So this is kind of the essence of what I wanted to say. And then working with thought patterns, we're going to do later in the afternoon, we'll do a teaching on shamatha or calm abiding practice. So then I'm going to talk more about how to relate with thought patterns. So this morning I just wanted to focus on subtle body, also how to sort of interact with emotions a little bit. So we have a half an hour. I was thinking to take a break at 12 for lunch break. We can do two things. We can either discuss as a group and sort of have question and answer slash discussion. I also wanted to, throughout the day, break off into small groups if you guys are interested in that. Because I'd really like for you guys to discuss it with each other. And sort of, I think it's going to be easier for some of you to talk about your experience with in a small group. And then, see, I'm already getting heads nodding. And then you guys can sort of report back to the larger group. And we can get some sort of, because I really, throughout the day, what I really want to focus on is I'm giving you like some, first we have to understand it cognitively. So I'm giving you a lot of cognitive information. But this isn't enough. We have to really bring it down to an emotional understanding and an experiential understanding, which will obviously take a lot of time outside of today. But here I'm hoping we can walk away with some sort of spark, some sort of something to go off of, yeah? But what I'm also really interested in is I want to get you guys to really engage with this. Think about it, but also experience it. Talk about it with each other. That's sort of what I want you guys to get out of today, whatever the topic we're discussing. So maybe we have a half an hour. So maybe for 10 minutes or so, we can break into small groups. And then maybe we can come back for 5 minutes or so and talk, just appoint one person out of the group to just bring up some ideas that you make sort of bullet points. And we'll do this again throughout the day, but make sort of bullet points. Okay, this is sort of, it can be anything. It could be experiences that the people in your small group had. It could also be, difficulties, you know, good experiences, difficulties. It could be concerns, questions, and then come up with two or three things. Wasn't hard to get you guys talking. I didn't even have to put any drugs in the water. Okay, I still didn't know, I'm just joking. So who wants to go? I mean, what I'm thinking is just one person from each group can just talk a little bit about experiences, difficulties, things like that, you know?
I'll go first.
Yeah?
I'm Leona, and most of the people in our group reported their general experience, but most of us touched into how helpful, in some ways, the breathing exercise was and how that was for us. And we had spent a lot of time with Joy, and she has a very interesting question about actually feeling the energy in her body. She does Thai massage, and she works really hard and a lot, and she finds the energy builds in her body. You know, tell me if I'm getting this wrong. And it gets stuck in her jaw and her throat.
Tension, really tight.
And at some point, if she can be with it, it moves up and it moves out of the top of her head and she feels pleasure and joy and ease.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time she spends with a great deal of tightness, clenching in the jaw to the point that her teeth are actually affected and very stressful.
Yeah.
I would like to know what is, as you keep to do like this, or energy, or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can help. I mean, this will help, you know. But I think just releasing tension here and doing this kind of thing, you know, I'm not quite sure the problem exactly, like, you know. But yeah, this will help with any kind of energy issue with that, you know. But as far as tension in here, yeah, I think also like mindfulness, bringing mindfulness to that, relaxing, you know, really using that first meditation we did, relaxing with the body.
Yeah.
We can talk more about it. Yeah. Maybe what I'm thinking, if you guys have specific questions, I think what we should do is all like talk about them after lunch. Does that make sense? But what you'll have to do is remember and then remind me. So we'll have a question and answer after lunch. But actually, it would be really good to do question and answer questions that came up during these small groups. So let's do it. But mention them now if you want, and then we'll sort of all think about it over lunch too. Yeah. Anybody?
In our group, the breathing exercise helped. One lady mentioned that she was used to it all being up here, so the breathing exercise helped her to take it down and create an intention. And then one lady mentioned that because it was always up here, it had to do with being in your mind. And it made the practice that you taught made us feel more grounded, you know, more down here, you know, and the energy is down here and it's more calming with it being down here than all the way up here, because when we're going through things, we're all up here, all ready to explode or whatever, you know. And then I wanted to say that I like what you kept saying throughout, is that it's okay. Just be okay with whatever's happening. If it's anger, whatever, just condition ourselves to start thinking in that way. You know, that whatever is supposed to be going on, it's supposed to be going on. It's okay. And that I'm okay. You know, no matter what I may be going through emotionally or whatever, I'm okay. And then we talked about how the attachments, we're so attached to different things and distracted, you know. So,
yeah.
And things can be a blur, you know, very blurry.
Really good. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about the technique of doing the breath that you were teaching and wanting to expand on that and to repeat it and get comfortable with it. We have somebody in our group who, I'm not sure if it was cured, but really had asthma relieved from doing this kind of breath work. And
today, or you mean in general?
In general, And talked about the subtle body, learning about it, wanting to be more in touch with it, and not keeping our emotions inside and getting out of our head was really important, something to realize here.
Good.
The group that I was in talked first about just how dropping into our body is part of our daily practice, and it seems like it's working for all of us pretty well. And talked about, I shared that I had been having an experience today where I was just wanting to cry a lot, especially when everyone shared at the beginning.
It's okay. You can cry.
Yeah, it was sort of that. That's what our discussion got into, was how even if you are cultivating this sense of it's okay, whatever's coming up for me, it's okay. I'm just going to feel it and be present with it. What happens when you're in a situation where it might not be okay for you just to be authentic? And I was feeling a lot of gratitude for the space and being able to be authentic, and for others feeling able to be authentic, and then the it's really scary though, you know, because you, yeah.
Yeah, I actually want to talk on that too, because I'll mention it now because you guys can remind me when we get back. But, you know, a lot of us in our culture also have a lot of trauma, and this can be overwhelming when we're approaching these kind of practices, because often when we're touching that, we can't touch the full-on feeling. We're just touching the edges of it, and then it triggers a lot of habitual response, which could be overwhelming emotion. That's okay. I think it's part of the process of going through it. But again, I'll put a caveat that depending on what the trauma is, I do think sometimes like traditional Western therapy can be helpful, you know, depending on what it is. So I'm not saying this is a cure-all for everyone. But definitely like once people work through more intense trauma, it doesn't have to be something really, it could be just a car accident or something like that. Like a car accident can, I didn't mention this, but maybe I'll mention that afternoon. Right now I'll say a little bit. What happens when we have a big trauma, like a car accident or something of that nature, the actual channels that I was explaining earlier, they get twists in them and they actually bend. So actually trauma creates disturbances in the subtle body that way. So then those can be very difficult to heal. It takes time. But this practice can actually heal it. So I think this practice is good for anybody, actually. You know, some Tibetan lamas even say that schizophrenia and things like that are actually womb imbalances. So some, I'm not sure personally, but some say like that. So even those kind of disorders, mental disorders, can be where the womb has gotten so out of balance and the sa, the channels have become so twisted that it manifests in a really overt mental disease, you know, mental disorder. But keep going, yeah. So what I wanted to say was, the main thing was often, we're not so used to touching sometimes really deeply in this kind of open fashion, our emotions and things like that. And sometimes we are, but this can bring up a lot. So I think you're right. If it's in a public thing, it can be difficult. So I think you have to bring it home and work with it. But also I think, this is why I want you guys to break off into small groups throughout the day. I notice with myself, especially when we're interacting with others, sometimes emotional releases and also emotional intelligence and experiences can actually come out that won't come out when we're alone. Mm-hmm. That's why I think it's really important. You know, that's why, you know, here I think everyone would agree we're creating a really safe space for everyone where you guys can express, you know, as much as you want within you know, reason. Don't freak out and break windows or anything. I don't think you will. But anyways, what I mean is, it's good if you can go be alone and work with it, but also you have to check, oh, is this something that I have to open up to with others? Like for me, that's one of my habitual patterns is to, you don't seem like this kind of person, but for me, this is my habitual pattern where I want to be like the lone warrior, you know, and not really engage with other people on what's really deeply going on. I think men have this issue quite a bit. It's more of a male thing, maybe. So then I have to force myself to open up to others, you know, and be kind of California-y. But anyway, yeah, finish with you. That's just what I wanted to say on that.
I think that was pretty much
it. Oh, that was it.
I like
thank
that
you.
Point you made, though.
Yeah.
Because I come to an environment like this to open up and to share.
Great.
Because I don't want to go back out there and be all, excuse my French, fucked up.
Yeah.
Because this is the environment. I trust the people in here. You know, because this is a deep setting.
Yeah.
And you come here to do your work and get your support and your love.
Mm-hmm.
It has been beautiful for me to be able to be vulnerable and transparent and get what I need.
Oh, great.
Because sometimes you can't get what you need in your homes.
It's true.
Or it's from true. Your partners or from other people. So this type of environment, I'm coming to do my work.
Great. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. And in our group, we discussed about it takes a while to work with the breath and to learn the subtle body before we can even bring the emotion in, because sometimes the emotion comes in and then all that practice is gone.
Yeah.
So it seems as if, you know, as you said, it takes a while to just practice that place of coming home and then letting the emotion come in. And how, when you said the word kindness, how it affects us, because we all tend to judge ourselves so harshly that when the word kindness comes in, it's really the sweet, the sweet sound that it touches a tender spot that we have to remember that we are judging. So here's the wall, and here comes the little cotton candy, and how can we merge it together?
Yeah.
And that sometimes the neutrality was a little bit foggy for some of us, that we hear that there's a balance there. And sometimes, though, we can get to a place in our lives where we're so calm all the time, everything is fine. Well, is there something wrong, or is there something right? Am I doing it right? And is that a goal we want to achieve? So I think that's another balance, another sort of discussion that we had too.
Yeah, I want to say one quick thing on that, because I don't want to be exclusive or sectarian. Also, I think in some of the Buddha, as a skillful means, taught many different kinds of teachings for different kinds of people. So actually, the way I'm teaching today a little bit, this is one jhana of the Buddha. Actually, it's a couple of jhanas. But what I'm emphasizing with the aspect of facing emotions and learning to kind of work with their energy, this is more of a certain jhana of the Buddha that might not be appropriate for everyone, actually. So then I don't want to exclude, in the sense where sometimes having just a calmness and facing the emotions, like, for instance, I'm a monk, so the jhana of the Buddha, being a monk, you're actually rejecting certain aspects of, you know, you're not getting married, you're not engaging in sexual intercourse, you're not, you can't kill, these kind of things. But some are in common with householder vows too. So that aspect of that jhana, you're actually creating a sense of rejection, which is skillful. You know, it's like creating a boundary around where you have walls, where then you say, okay, I can't engage with these sort of activities so skillfully, so I'm going to create some sort of boundary. So it's a skillful means. So again, I just wanted to, you weren't saying anything, I just wanted to, it was something I remembered to say, because I want to be clear about that in some aspects of Buddha Dharma, it's okay to just be calm, and it's okay to just, like, say, okay, these are negative, and I'm not, and push them over here. But the reason I'm talking about this jhana more, it comes from actually Vajrayana, believe it or not, is because I think for us Westerners, we're so used to rejecting in this really harmful way, you know, where it creates all kinds of lung disturbances, like I've been saying. It also creates sort of mental patterns that aren't skillful, you know? And so I think this method of really being gentle, a lot of openness with the emotions, using a dropping, trying to find the energy behind that emotion, these are coming from Vajrayana a little bit, some Mahayana Buddhism. This is really skillful, I think, for Westerners, because we especially have a tendency to reject these things in a really, oppressive and harmful way. Yeah. So that's the reason I've been teaching here, just to,
Cool.
Yeah.
That relates to the comment from my group, which is that people were unused to having psychological and emotional processes addressed and integrated.
Yes.
To the point where they almost felt it was a different category of psychotherapy as opposed to spiritual practice.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm just going to comment on them now because they're kind of fresh. Yeah. We can wait a little bit for lunch. We'll still take that same amount of time, I promise. Basically, the sort of method I'm following today is a little bit from the sort of what my teacher Sokhen Rinpoche has learned about our society, and what's a very skillful way to approach the Dharma. It might not be for everyone, but it's a way. And so often what he finds is that we can approach spiritual practice, and we can approach just the really hardcore Dharma. For instance, in Tibetan Buddhism, they never talk about this, actually. You never hear a Tibetan Lama say what I just said this morning, because it's like, they're saying, you know, it's actually about, it's more having to do with this life, You know, it's not necessarily having to do with creating future karma for better lives or creating a way out of samsara. But actually, Sogyen Rinpoche's opinion is it is. It's like you need this healthy base, a healthy sense of ego, a healthy sense of okayness, well-being in your emotional center. Otherwise, no matter how much spiritual practices we do, they'll never penetrate. So he's sort of seen over the years many spiritual groups. And of course you have a range of people. So of course some people aren't going to have as many emotional disturbances as others, and some might have more. So, but in general he's seen that, and you know, the reason I'm teaching here is I've really seen it in myself, and so the approaches have really worked with me. And to a certain degree, I'm a student in this, and I'm continuing to work on it. But so that's more the approach here. There is a little bit of psychology. Buddhism has psychology too, but in general, it is a bit more on that level. The afternoon we'll be taking it to see. So it's sort of like Sogyen Rinpoche talked about. He has this like healthy human being, and then beyond human being, because the Buddha is actually beyond a human being. I mean, they could take a birth in a human body, but they don't have the mind of samsara. They're not stuck, or an arhat. They're not stuck in that sort of samsaric mindset. They don't grasp at objects the same way and then experience karmic patterns because of them. So, that's what I found, that he's right, Sogyen Rinpoche. And it's often what happens to people is this thing called spiritual bypassing. You know, which is becoming a little bit of a popular term now. This guy John and Jennifer Wellwood,
yes,
in the Marin, they teach a lot of nice techniques around this, where it's very easy for us to, especially Tibetan Buddhism. I'm going to really criticize some Tibetan Buddhism now, because none of you are Tibetan Buddhists, right? Not officially, you either. Yeah. But anyways, I'm going to criticize a little bit. You know, there's so many bells and whistles going on, and so many things often that. Westerners get really attracted to that. And they're like, oh, cool, I can put on this robe and light this incense and blah, blah, blah. Zen, I think, is a lot more nice for this, because there's not so much, but there is a lot of accoutrements in Zen, too, but it's a little bit more simple. So then it's very easy for people to spiritual bypass, because they'll use all the things to build sort of a spiritual practice, including the meditation itself, but they've never penetrated their own emotions, you know? So it's something that I think is really key to, in every culture that the Dharma goes to, from India into Tibet, Afghanistan, China, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, right? Korea. So every culture that Buddhism has penetrated to, the essence never changed, because you had realized beings coming from India and bringing that. But then slightly the way it sort of manifests or expresses itself changes according to the cultural needs of that culture. Now, this is a big question in the West. You know, I'd like to talk about it a little bit today. It's a big question about, you know, people often, I read things now where they're talking about like a Western Dharma or these kind of things. We're really babies, you know. I don't even know if you could call like a Buddhism Western Buddhism yet. It took like 400, 500 years in Tibet, I think. And I'm sure a really long time in China and these other countries. The reason being is there has to be a way for the essence of the Dharma not to be lost, but the cultural specific habitual patterns to be addressed. You see? So this is really tricky how to do this. Address the cultural patterns without losing the essence. You know? It's really close to my heart. I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's... Anyways, I don't know if that's...
Well, one other aspect of that, in thinking of Western psychoanalysis, to what degree my tendency is to reinforce the concept of self,
mm-hmm,
by delving into my emotions?
Yeah, that can happen too.
How you separate...
This is the afternoon. I'm putting everything after. I'm putting a lot of pressure on myself. So more or less, we're creating with these practices I talked about already. We're trying to create a healthy base, a healthy sense of okayness, where they're just, you know, our happiness isn't based off of conditioned reality. It's not based on if I get this, then I feel good. You see, that's the basic sense we want to get to. It's very difficult in our culture. You see, because everything is based off of you get this. Everyone's telling us that. School, parents, commercials, everything. So it's very hard to counter this. That's why I think working with the subtle body, working with the base of emotion, getting a lot of health and well-being there, that's the last thing. Then we can move on to the work of then to deconstructing. You see? So if we try to deconstruct the self, I guess you could say in a way, the like an inherently existing self, if we try to deconstruct that right away, you get a lot of weird things happening to people, I'll tell you. Yeah. So myself included. So it's very tricky. It's, see what I mean?
Yeah,
these are these cultural aspects of the Dharma that are very subtle. And so it's you could say at the end of the day it's individual. I mean, that's why really we have to be, you know, if we're really into the Dharma, and the Dharma I mean in a really general way, you know, we really have to like take responsibility and a lot of like care over ourselves. Does that make sense? You know? A lot of really investigating and seeing, okay, how am I? What this teacher said, does it apply to me? You know? It's not a religion of blind religion, you know? So you really have to check. So it's, and then I think, this is what I think is difficult for a lot of people. The checking isn't to create some kind of doubt or to create some intellectual idea or to build our own ego up. The checking is so that later when we practice, we have more certainty of what we're doing. You see what I'm saying? It creates sort of that kind of certainty. Anyways, I'm going to shut up now. I totally went into your thing. Did you have any more to say? It just triggered something really that I really is passionate for me. You know what I mean? This aspect of, because I used to be a little bit hardcore Buddha. I call it like, what do you call it?
Fundamentalist.
A little fundamentalist. I still am a little bit, you know. But fundamentalism, the word actually is interesting because it has a negative connotation, but the word is not so negative. But I've thought, but.
Dogmatic. But,
yeah, maybe dogmatic is a better word. Yeah. So then what I had to come to the conclusion, my teacher is slowly, you know, chopping me up. I had to come to the conclusion, oh, you're as effed up as anyone else. You know what I mean? I thought I somehow wasn't, you know. But I'm as effed up as anyone. More so, if not, you know. So,
that brings a lot of humility and
compassion. Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
I mean,
it does.
Definitely humility. And so it's, what was my point with that? Oh, so yeah, I've had to sort of go outside of the realm of a traditionalist and sort of more realize, okay, these are approaches I need. But then, I think I was talking to Jill and Bruce about this last night, and what my remedy for this is creating clarity. Because I think what happens often in Buddhism in the West is, this is my opinion right now, is there's not a lot of clarity for people, so then sometimes there is a lot of clarity, too much. So what can happen is then a lot of techniques that are more psychology get sort of pinned as this is Buddhism. When actually Buddhism, you know, you're trying to actually achieve something that's beyond human being eventually. But if we don't address these psychological issues, it's very difficult to penetrate, like I said, it's very difficult to penetrate into something beyond the human being. So, or to work on those practices. So, what I was thinking about lately and what I talked to Joan Bruce about last night is this aspect of clarity. It's like just being really clear. Hey, these are methods and psychological methods from the Buddha, but we're teaching them in a more secular way, you see? And then these are religious teachings. And then people can choose. And also people then have clarity. Okay, I don't know if I'm into the whole Buddhist trip, but I can use these meditations to gain some help in my life and to feel, I mean, really, this is something I want you guys to investigate over lunch because it's kind of a hard question. It's not easy. I'm sorry, I'm being a little, I have some provocative questions today.
Yeah.
I apologize if I offend anyone. That's just sort of my personality. What do we want out of meditation? I'm not assuming all of you are Buddhists. I'm just assuming you're interested in meditation and practicing this. Yeah. So what do we want out of it? You know, do we just want to feel good? That's okay, though. You see what I'm saying? That's okay. But we have to be really, we have to know our intention, you know? And it's not bad to just want to feel good. I think what the issue comes is when people get really religious about something. But they say, oh, I want enlightenment. But actually, they just want to feel good. You see? I mean, but it's okay, just be honest. But it doesn't mean that someone has to say, oh, I found my real intention, I just want to feel good. And then they're like, oh, I'm going to take down my altar, give it all away, and blah, blah, blah. You don't have to go that far. You know what I'm saying? It's just being mindful, knowing, investigating, knowing where we're really at. You see what I'm saying? In the same boat, you don't, just because you aren't interested in the religious aspects, and you just want to use it for mental health, mental well-being, right? Emotional well-being. It doesn't mean you have to write off the more religious aspects too, you see? So I think it's this aspect. So once we have more clarity with that, it's much easier to, what do you call it, have success. I hate using that word because success in this kind of realm is so, like, you know what I mean? Like, we want to think so linear a lot of the time, but actually it's like this, you know? It's totally crazy. It's a very strange path, you know? And once you jump on the path, you know, it's not always fun. So I think that's the thing, is if we want to feel good, there's a point at the path where you don't feel good. And it's painful. But it's a different kind of pain, you know? The chocolate kind of pain, we don't know is pain, but it's actually pain. Yeah, the suffering of change. Feels good to eat it. I really like the taste. And then I get fat. And also, it created more attachment for me. And at the end of the day, it didn't satisfy my attachment. Yeah. You know, the Buddha said it's like drinking salt water. So I think these are the kind of things. See, now I'm segueing into our after lunch discussion. These are the kind of things that we have to be interested in if we're interested in Buddha Dharma. It's really not, it's actually. I really like, I was listening to teaching of Dzongsar Tenzin Rinpoche, who's quite a popular lama now. He's very funny, very modern, very applicable to Westerners, speaks English really fluently. And he said, you know, I don't think Buddhism will ever be that popular, you know? We're always talking about suffering and, you know, all these kind of things. And I really thought about what he said, and it's kind of true, you know? And so when you really look at it, it comes down to the Four Noble Truths. But the Four Noble Truths are beautiful, because if Buddha just taught the first two, not so beautiful. But he taught the last two, you know? There is a way out of this life, you know? The Eightfold Path, yeah? So, so we really have to think about this realm of you know, what's our intentions? Because then once our intentions become clear, our path can become more clear. Otherwise, it remains wishy-washy. We end up 30 years practicing Dharma and wondering, what the hell have I been doing for 30 years? You know? I'm being really honest now, okay? I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend anyone or offend your friends or anyone you know. I'm just being really honest because I think, you know, it's if we want to make a change, this is what we need, you know? This kind of attitude, yeah? And then, I want to go back to this quote just right before we break for lunch. Wait, did anybody else not report? I stopped there. Was that all the groups? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, good. So this first part of the verse, we are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. So I'm not really going to say much about this because this is going to be more in the teaching coming after lunch, but I want you guys to think about that a little bit. You know? We are what we think, and all that we are arises with our thoughts. I don't want you to accept this. I want you to think about it. Is that true? You see what I'm saying? I don't know. Now I'm thinking about it too. Yeah? Okay, so maybe we'll break for lunch, yeah? We're not going to do, at the end of the, oh yeah, they want to have an announcement real quick. So we're breaking about 12:30, so let's come back at 2, so it's a nice long lunch. You guys can, you know, relax a little. That's what I'm saying. If you eat, you know, it's nice to, we have a day long, right? Which is so precious. I don't know how much time you guys have throughout your lives, but most of us do not have a lot of time. So having a day just to focus on this kind of thing is so rare. So make it useful. Like, go eat, socialize a little bit, but then go take a walk and think about these things, yeah? Otherwise, it's just like, you came here, blah, 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 and then you leave, and then nothing. You know, we just forget it. I mean, I'm like that, you know, so I'm just speaking more from personal experience. So instead, at the end of the day, we'll recite these dedications, but right now I just want you guys just to think for a minute. And we're just going to dedicate any kind of merit collected, any kind of virtuous intention, meditation, just in your heart really dedicated to transformation, waking up, in whatever capacity we want, and then being able to benefit others through that transformation.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.